Our Gritty Economy.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. The U.S. economy has displayed quite a bit of toughness in recent months. The problems in the housing and credit markets haven't sunk the ship. But there are certainly leaks. This morning, the government said orders for durable goods fell in October for the third straight month. More now from Elisa Roth.
Durable goods are items designed to last at least 3 years, like cars, appliances, electronic equipment. Orders for those goods dropped by 0.4% in October, but take out defense spending, which is expensive, and it dropped by 2.3%. That's the biggest drop since February. Ryan Reed is an economist at National City.
The credit crunch has certainly put some fear into some businesses as far as their long-term prospects. It's down this month, but marginally down, and not too much off of the trend that we've been seeing this year. So it's not something that I'm worried about yet.
The durable goods numbers are known for their volatility, and Reed says it'll take at least a few more months of big drops before he gets really nervous. But this month's numbers, especially when taken with declines in August and September, do suggest manufacturing is slowing down. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Despite that, Wall Street is in good spirits this morning. A top Federal Reserve official hinted that more interest rate cuts could be on the way. So the Dow is up 130 points already to 13,097. The Nasdaq has gained 43. The S&P 500 is up 19. The European markets are having a strong day, too, up about 1.5%. The price of oil has dropped the last few days, but it's still $5 from $100 a barrel. Let's bring in our European correspondent, Stephen Beard. Stephen, I know OPEC had something to say this morning. What's their position at the moment?
Well, OPEC, of course, is coming under intense pressure from consuming countries like the US to pump more oil to prevent the price from going over that $100 a barrel level. But now, again, the Saudi oil minister and the president of OPEC have both just repeated the familiar mantra. They say there's plenty of oil around.
But is there any evidence that OPEC is wrong here, that there actually is a tighter market for oil?
Yes, I mean, some of the analysts that I've been talking to say that evidence from the market and from various data around the planet indicate that actually oil supplies are tight and there are definite worries about winter demand. And they point to the fact that the price of crude fell pretty sharply yesterday, precisely because of expectations that, in fact, OPEC will relent and next month it will increase production.
Well, I guess we'll find out more, Stephen, when OPEC meets next week. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, Scott.
One constant in the price of oil is tension in the Middle East. Yesterday in Annapolis, Maryland, Israelis and Palestinians agreed to revive peace talks. But commentator David Frum says even if there is peace, it won't affect oil.
Oil is hitting record prices for two big reasons: our old friends, Mr. Supply and Madame Demand. 20 years ago, China and India barely registered on the world oil market. Today, China is the world's second biggest oil consumer and number three importer, and India is the world's sixth biggest consumer and number eight importer. While the demand side booms, the supply side looks gloomy. Of the world's top 15 net oil exporters, only three at most, Norway, Canada, and, charitably, Mexico, offer secure investment regimes and reliable political stability. The rest of the list looks like a roster of international danger zones: Russia, Iran, Venezuela, Nigeria. Then, of course, you have the Arab oil producers, whose oligarchic regimes frustrate their young, underemployed populations. People connect oil to Middle East peace because of the experience of the boycott during the 1973 Yom Kippur War. They forget that the Arab exporters imposed a similar boycott in 1967. That first boycott failed because market conditions were against it. The second succeeded because in the inflationary 1970s, market conditions favored it. It's the market conditions, not the political decisions, that matter. We cannot predict now the exact path by which future oil supply and future oil demand will adjust to today's painful prices. We can only be certain that they will. And when they do, they will be driven by market events, not the will-o'-the-wisp of Annapolis.
David Frum was a speechwriter for President Bush. He's now a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. You're listening to The Morning Report for Wednesday, November 28th on Marketplace.org. The Securities and Exchange Commission takes up the thorny issue of shareholder rights today. Commissioners are expected to put restrictions in place, even though a recent federal court ruling opened the door for shareholder activism. The SEC is also expected to support more online communication between corporations and their owners. Jill Barshay has more on that.
Relations between companies and their shareholders are contentious. Tom Lehner represents 160 large U.S. companies at the Business Roundtable. He says every one of them wastes time and money battling shareholder proposals on their annual proxy ballots.
Everything from environmental resolutions to social responsibility resolutions that oftentimes don't have any direct relation to the company's core business.
So the SEC is trying to play marital counselor. It's hoping the internet can provide neutral ground for shareholders and companies to hash out their problems.
This is getting at the heart of this age-old issue, whether you're talking about a marriage or, you know, any group of people, that improved communications always leads to better relationships.
Lehner says companies won't even go near message boards until they get liability protection from the SEC. He says that's what the SEC is expected to give corporations today. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
The British security firm Armour Group International announced a drop in profits yesterday. The company essentially blamed its rival Blackwater. It said fewer contracts have been awarded since Blackwater employees killed 17 Iraqi civilians in September. So has that incident really had an adverse effect on other private contractors? Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
The Blackwater shootings may have hurt the reputations of private security firms, but not necessarily their bottom lines. Peter Singer is with the Brookings Institution and wrote the book Corporate Warriors. He says even Blackwater itself hasn't lost its contract yet.
A lot of people think it's going to end up the next time it comes up to bid, but there isn't, like you've seen, a wave of the U.S. government announcing, okay, actually now we're canceling all of these contracts that we have here, there, and everywhere. That just hasn't happened in the marketplace yet.
He says the fortunes of these firms hinge on multiple factors.
It's legal factors, it's security factors, it's grand politics on a global level, and it's politics on a very small micro level.
For now, private security is still in high demand in Iraq, and governments and corporations aren't the only ones hiring. Singer says his organization found that one human rights group had its own sniper team. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Frequent flyer programs were designed to build passenger loyalty. The free tickets were a nice bonus, but those miles might not be worth quite as much as you think. Here's Stacey Vanek Smith.
Service no matter what you pay.
With first-class legroom, free cocktails for everyone.
Oh, how times have changed for air travel. Discount carriers like JetBlue were part of the problem. They've pushed ticket prices and profit margins down for the airline industry. Mark Ashley edits the travel blog Upgrade. He says there is one part of the airline business that's still flying high.
The airlines make a heck of a lot of money by selling frequent flyer miles to credit card companies, restaurants.
At the same time, airlines have made it harder to redeem those miles. In Delta SkyMiles program, flyers usually hand over 25,000 miles for a domestic ticket, but it's subject to restrictions. If you're willing to burn 50,000 miles, you can get a seat on any flight you want. But starting December 1st, certain Delta flights will be off limits for rewards, no matter how many miles you're willing to pay. Mark Ashley says that's a snub to Delta's customers.
If you make it harder and harder to cash in your miles, then you risk losing those customers as frequent flyer loyalists.
But these days, most travelers aren't loyal, says Airline Business Magazine's David Field.
If you ask a customer, what are the most important considerations in your choosing airline A or airline B, they'll mention four things: fare, fare, and schedule.
Other airlines will be watching Delta closely, says aviation analyst Richard Abulafia. They'll want to see if the airline loses customers.
You don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. You just want to strangle it till it gives you every last egg. You don't want to alienate people who are part of a customer loyalty program. On the other hand, you want to maintain profitability on this loyalty program.
Perhaps to make it more attractive to potential buyers. Abulafia says many airlines are considering unloading their frequent flyer programs. Could be a good idea. Earlier this year, Bear Stearns priced the United Airlines rewards plan at nearly $23 billion. That's roughly four times the value of the carrier itself. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
TV and movie writers are in their third day of talks with the Hollywood studios. The late-night shows have been in reruns since the writers' strike began 3 weeks ago. But one host is about to cross the picket line. Renita Jablonski has more.
It's Last Call with Carson Daly.
Carson Daly will be the first late-night host to go back to work since the strike began November 5th. His NBC show plans to resume taping today for new episodes that'll start airing next week. The network told non-writing staff of Daly's show layoffs are possible at the end of the week unless new programs were produced. Same goes for The Tonight Show with Jay Leno and Late Night with Conan O'Brien.
And now, here's your host, Carson Daly.
No surprise, the Writers Guild of America isn't applauding Daly's decision. Daytime host Ellen DeGeneres resumed taping her talk show a day after the strike started and has been called a scab, though DeGeneres, unlike Daly, is a member of the WGA. In Los Angeles, I'm Renita Jablonski for Marketplace.
A guy walked into a South Carolina bank on Monday and told the teller he wanted to open an account. He gave the teller one bill. It had a picture of Grover Cleveland on it. Looked real enough. Except for the denomination.
$1 million.
Of course, the government has never printed a $1 million bill, and the guy was arrested. For the record, the largest denomination ever printed was a $100,000 bill. It was printed back in the 1930s. In Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.